very briefly, in Genesis, Moses explains to the children of Israel, because they're coming out of Egypt, that's the time period when this is being written, their origin, the sovereign establishment of a promised and chosen seed. And of course, he begins on chapter 1 with explaining that he is the creator. He created everything, everything in the heavens, everything in the earth, everything that lives, everything that exists. So that's chapter 1. Chapter 2, he gives greater detail on the creation of man and the woman, the establishment of marriage. Chapter 3, the fall into sin. Though God rightly punishes Adam and Eve for their refusal to obey his one command, not to eat the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he also gives them hope. And from this point on, Genesis chapter 3, verse 15 on, we are tracing through Scripture that hope. There is going to be one that comes, one that is the seed of the woman, that is going to crush the serpent's head. And so we're tracing that through. Hope right there. There is a future redeemer. In chapter 4, Eve has her first son, Cain. She is hopeful that this is the redeemer. But he's not. He is a murderer. He kills his brother Abel, and his descendants who follow him are also evil. In chapter 5, Moses traces the line, the godly line, through Seth to Noah. And though this is the godly line, they also are affected by sin. The average age of these patriarchs is 912 years old, but sin still affects them. Because as the chart there shows, the line ends, they die. Chapter 6, the wickedness of man has increased to the point that every intent of the thoughts of his heart were only evil continually. And so God decided he was going to destroy mankind with a flood. Except for Noah, who found grace in the eyes of the Lord, and God spared him, his family, and two of each kind of animal, air-breathing land animal, alive and saved from the flood that destroyed the world that was, as 2 Peter describes it. When Noah and his family, the animals, departed from the ark a little over a year after they had entered it, it was a different world. Rain was now a normal part of weather. The rainbow became a reminder of the covenant that God had made with Noah, that he would never destroy the world again through a flood. But other things had changed too. Animals were now given to man as a source of food. Capital punishment for murder of a man was instituted because man is made in the image of God. But one thing had not changed, and that was man's bent to sin. The particular sin of Canaan brought a curse upon him and his descendants. Noah's descendants were then told to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. The same command had been given to Adam and Eve. But in chapter 11, we find that a majority of them followed Nimrod in defiance of God's command. They decided they were going to stay in Babel, and they'd build a tower whose top would reach into heaven. A false worship was instituted. But God intervened. He confused the languages, and he forced their dispersal. So they spread out over the earth, the various family groups moving to different areas, and that was detailed for us in chapter 10. In chapter 12, after the tracing of the descendants of Shem to Abraham, we meet Abraham, to whom God gives a covenant. And it includes being the one through whom all nations on earth would be blessed. That promise back in 3:15 is being traced through. And it's in Abraham, it's delineated. It is in his descendants that this Redeemer would come. Other aspects of a unilateral covenant that God made with Abraham included being given a particular land. It was the land the Canaanites were currently occupying. It was given to him for eternity and his descendants. He was going to have descendants as numerous as the stars, and that latter promise was going to take God's intervention. Because Sarai, at this point in time, is already past the age of childbearing. But as Genesis 15:6 tells us, Abraham believed God and was counted to him as righteousness. Then, after 10 years of waiting, Sarai had a plan to bring about a child because she still didn't have any children. So she decides she would give Hagar, her handmaid, to Abraham and have a child through her. The result was Ishmael. And though Abram loved Ishmael, and though Ishmael would become a great nation himself, the father of 12 tribes, the covenant would not be passed through Ishmael. God made it clear the covenant was going to be would go through a son who would be named Isaac, that would be from Abraham and Sarah. In Now, by the time that happens, Sarah is 90 years old. Meanwhile, the sin of the Canaanites was continuing to increase. It became so bad in Sodom and Gomorrah that God sent two angels to destroy those cities. And yet, at the same time, God had grace on Lot, Abraham's nephew, and saved him and his immediate family from that destruction. It also became the origin of the Moabites, the Ammonites, who later became troublesome to the nation of Israel. Well, Sarah did give birth to Isaac the next year, and soon afterward, Hagar and her son were sent away. Ishmael ended up living in the wilderness of Paran. His family settled in the northern area of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, but was driven away because Ishmael would not hold any inheritance with Isaac. In chapter 22, which is where we ended a couple weeks ago, God gives Abraham his greatest test, asking him to sacrifice his son Isaac. Abraham's faith, as we had studied him, we had seen wavered at times. There are times it was very strong. He believed God for things that were impossible. And other times, it's like he ignored what God had just said and he was going to use his own wisdom, do it his own way. Well, with this test, there could be no wavering. He was either going to have to trust God and carry out the command, or he was going to have to reject God. And Abraham believed and obeyed. God stopped the sacrifice after Abraham had already picked up the knife to slay Isaac. And then God provided a ram, a substitute sacrifice. The ram was caught in the thicket. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 17 through 19 comments about Abraham's faith, saying this. It says, "By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, 'In Isaac your descendant shall be called.' He considered that God is able to raise men even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type." And that's why Abraham is called the father of the faithful. Everything was tied up in Isaac. All the promises, going back all the way to Genesis 3:15, were in Isaac. God would have to raise him from the dead, because there was no other way. And that's what Abraham believed. Believed him for the impossible. Do you believe him for the impossible? Because that's the kind of God we serve. He does the impossible all the time. Well, this morning we pick it up from chapter 22. We're going to be covering chapters 23 through 36. I know some of you don't believe I can do that. But I've already proven I can cover several chapters at a time. Let's see if I can cover about 13 chapters in one shot. So hang on to your hats. We're going to go fast. Chapter 23, we find that Sarah dies at age 127. Abraham purchases the cave of Machpelah as a burial ground and becomes the family burial site. Now, that Sarah has died, though, there's another question in Abraham's mind. Okay, it's all bound up in Isaac, but Isaac has to have descendants too. He's got to find a wife. Where is he going to get this wife? Now, Abraham, by this point, he's at least 137, somewhere between that and 140. He's got to find a bride for Isaac. Where do you get a bride? Well, in chapter 24, Abraham places his servant under an oath to find a bride for Isaac from among Abraham's relatives in Haran. Specific in the oath is that he was not to get a bride for him from among the Canaanites. Remember, the Canaanites were cursed. He did not want that bloodline mingled together, where the blessing and the curse are co-joined. Isaac had to have a bride from a different group. Now, this task is going to be more difficult because the servant cannot take Isaac with him. So whatever woman that he finds has to agree to travel from Haran, and I think I got the, from Haran, there he goes, way up to Haran, all the way back to the southern part of Canaan, without ever seeing this guy. How many of you women would say, "Hey, great, I hear about this guy and I'm just going to go marry him. I've never even seen him, talked to him. I don't have a letter from him, nothing. All I got is a servant that says he's a good guy." Does that sound like a good basis for marriage? No? Okay. Well, this was God's plan. Abraham told the servant that the Lord would send an angel before him and guide him through all of it. But there was one escape clause. if the woman was unwilling to come back, the servant was released from his oath. Well, the servant set out for Haran with a variety of gifts for the bridal price. It took 10 camels to carry it all. Headed out for the city of Nahor in Mesopotamia. Now, the faith of Abraham had also affected the servant. And upon his arrival, he petitions the Lord. Look there in verses 12 through 14. Here's his prayer. And he said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camels also, may she be the one whom thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac. And by this I shall know that thou hast shown loving kindness to my master. Before he even finishes this prayer, Rebecca, who is Abraham's grandniece, comes out with her water jar and does everything exactly as the servant had prayed. Every single detail. When Rebecca's finished watering the camels, he gives her a half shekel gold ring and two gold bracelets totaling 10 shekels. Now, I know all of you know what shekels are. You know exactly the value of this. You don't? Well, let me tell you. A shekel was about 60 days of labor. That's what a shekel represented. So this is 630 days of labor. That's over 2 years of work in value in these gifts that he gave her right then. Now, if you were a girl and someone gave you something worth 2 years of labor, would you be impressed with the person? I think so. At least you know there's some wealth in this family. Well, then he also explains exactly who he is. Well, Rebecca runs back and tells her family about it. Meanwhile, the servant bows low, it tells us in verse 26, and worshiped the Lord and said, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward my master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master brothers. He has great confidence in exactly what God is doing, to the very details of it. His master's brother. Well, again, Rebecca runs home, tells her family what had happened, and her brother Laban comes out and meets Abraham's servant, escorts him to their home. They take care of the camels. They give water to him to clean up. But he says, I'm not going to eat until I tell you all that I came here to do. So he explained that he was Abraham's servant, the oath he had taken to find a wife for Isaac, his prayer upon his arrival, how Rebecca fulfilled exactly this prayer. And then he puts it directly to him. Are you going to deal kindly with and truly with my master or not? And they recognize the Lord's hand in it, and so they consent. And the servant then brought out all the gifts he had brought for Rebecca and her family. Now, they feasted that night, and we can understand that. Wow, this is from my relative Abraham. We haven't heard anything for years. And probably a lot of catching up on what was going on, and certainly they were probably enamored by 10 camels worth of gifts coming out. But again, this is all quite sudden. The next morning, they get up, and the servant says, let me now go back to my master. Now, he's been there how long? Not even a full day? And he wants to take Rebecca and go. And they defer, and, you know, this is pretty sudden. How many of you parents would, you know, enjoy this? Some guy shows up and say, I'm going to take your daughter and bye. We're going to take her far away. You'll never see her again. It's too far for you to travel. And you're going to say, what? Well, that's what they did. Let her stay a couple of days. You know, let us get used to the idea. At least say goodbye to her. Have her friends come. Say goodbye. And he says, no, he needs to go. And so they put the question to Rebecca. And she says she agrees to go. So very fast. And again, I don't know that any of you would probably think this is the way to get a wife. But it worked for them, didn't it? But there was a lot of confidence they had in exactly what God was doing. Notice again how the servant had put it. The woman God had appointed for Isaac. They saw God's hand in it every step of the way. Well, Rebecca, along with her nurse, then left that day on the trip to Beer Lahai Roy in the Negev where Isaac was living. And she became his wife. Just before they left, her relatives gathered around her and blessed her. And it's quite a blessing, too. It says, may you, our sister, become thousands of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them. To be prosperous and victorious. Well, in chapter 25, we find that Abraham took another wife after the death of Sarah, and Keturah bore him 6 more sons. Abraham gave gift to these sons as they got older, and then sent them away to the east while he was still alive. But the inheritance was reserved strictly for Isaac alone. There's an emphasis on this through Scripture. Yes, there's other sons, but only Isaac gets the inheritance. Abraham lived to be 175 before he died, and then Isaac and Ishmael buried him alongside Sarah in the cave at Machpelah. Now, Isaac was 40 when he married Rebekah, and then she was barren for 20 years, and she was grieved over this. Isaac then prayed for her, and she conceived twins who were then struggling within her womb. She inquired the Lord about it, and the Lord revealed to her in Genesis 25:23 the nature of these children and what the future would hold. Genesis 25:23 says, "Two nations are in your womb, and two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." So right from the beginning, before the children are even born, the Lord's prophecy is what's going to happen with these two kids, these two boys. Now, the first child born was red and hairy all over, and so he's named Esau. Esau means hairy. Aren't you glad you're not named that? Not Harry, H-A-R-R-Y, but H-A-I-R-Y. Hi, Harry. But holding on to Harry was Jacob. And Jacob names the one who takes by the heel. Now, how would you like to have that name? Quite a name. What does that mean? Well, it goes back to my birth. I wouldn't let my brother go. I'm following him right out. But that's how close they were in the struggle. Now, Esau grew up to be a skillful hunter and a man of the field. Esau was also very impulsive. Didn't think a lot about what the future would hold or how what he did now would affect the future. It's whatever's the moment. Esau was favored by Isaac. Isaac was a man of the field. And Isaac liked game, and Esau would go get it for him. Now, Jacob was the opposite. Jacob is a peaceful man. He lives in tents. He is someone who does think about the future. He's a planner. Some would say a schemer. He is favored by his mother. Now, between the rivalry or the favoritism between mom and dad and the differences in character, we soon find that Esau is going to squander his birthright. Jacob had cooked some stew. Esau had been out in the field. He comes back and he's hungry. And he finds Jacob and he says, "Please let me have a swallow of," the way this really should be translated is, the red stuff there. "I'm hungry." He's an articulate fellow too. Because that's all he says, the red stuff. Whatever it is, he doesn't care. He's just hungry. "Feed me." Now, Jacob gets the idea here. I'll feed him. Only after he promises me the birthright. And so Esau accepts the deal. Verse 34 states very clearly, "Thus Esau despised his birthright, sold it for a pot of lentil stew." And that's why Hebrews 12:16 calls him a godless person. It's also where he picked up the name Edom. Edom, we'll find out through Scripture, is even the name of the territory that his descendants inhabited. Edom means red. Now, as we go on, we find there was a famine in the land, and Isaac moved to Gerar near Abimelech, where Abraham had lived previously. And God specifically told him not to go down to Egypt, and then God repeated the Abrahamic covenant and applied it to him. Later, Isaac moves to Beersheba, and God again repeats his covenant. It's there in chapter 26, verse 24. He says, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham." Same covenant. He goes to Isaac. Now, Abimelech also made a covenant with him, just as had been done earlier with Abraham. Chapter 27 records the deception that occurs in the family when parents play favorites with their children. They set up a rivalry. And though the Lord had said to Jacob, much earlier, when the children were still in the womb, that to Isaac, that Jacob would be superior to Esau, And though Esau had already sold the birthright to Jacob, Rebekah uses deception to gain for Jacob the blessing as well. Now, in brief, Isaac was getting older. His eyesight was dimming. He took this as a sign that he's about to die. And so he tells Esau to go out, hunt some game, bring it back, because he loves game, and when he does that, I will give you the blessing. Now, we don't think much about it in our culture, but in their culture, this was extremely serious. When the father would pronounce a blessing, it was prophetic for the future of that child. So Esau goes away. Now, Rebekah heard this, and while Esau is gone, she prepares a kid from the flock, and she knows exactly what Isaac likes. She's been cooking for him for a long time, puts all the spices in it. He doesn't realize he's eating goat. He thinks he's got game. Sends in Jacob with it, but disguises Jacob. Puts Jacob in Esau's clothing, so he's going to smell like Jacob. Puts on the skin from the goats on the back of his hands, because Jacob was a smooth man, Esau was hairy, and on the back of his neck. It's all deception. Remember, Isaac doesn't see so well, but he's going to feel, he's going to smell. He comes in, and Jacob does completely deceive Isaac, because he also lies, goes on with his mother's plan, and gets the blessing from Jacob. The blessing there is in chapter 27, 27 through 29. It says, "See, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Now may God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and abundance of grain and new wine. May people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master of your brothers and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you and blessed be those who bless you." Now, this blessing also fits in with the Abrahamic covenant, too. Now, of course, when Esau came back, the deception is exposed. But it's too late. The blessing's already given to Jacob. The only blessing Isaac has left to give Esau, who is pleading for something, is there in verse 39. "Behold, away from the fertility of the earth shall be your dwelling, away from the dew of heaven from above. By your sword you shall live, and your brother you shall serve. But it shall come about when you become restless that you shall break his yoke from your neck." That's a blessing that sounds more like a curse, doesn't it? Well, Esau's reactions, he starts plotting how he is going to kill Jacob once his father dies. Now, Rebekah, of course, hears about it, and she comes up with another plan. She's going to send Jacob away until Esau's anger subsided. Her plan is to send him to Haran, under the pretext that she can't stand the daughters of Canaan, which actually she couldn't, but the pretext is he's got to go up there and find a wife. And Isaac agrees to it, so Jacob goes. Off he goes to Haran, where he's going to find someone who is actually more deceptive than himself. Now, on the journey, Jacob had a dream one night, in which he saw a ladder with its bottom on the earth, and going all the way to heaven, angels were going up and down on this ladder. At the top of the ladder was the Lord, and this is what he dreamed that the Lord said to him. Verse 13, "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your descendants. Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south, and in you and your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land, and I will not leave you until I have done for you what I have promised." That's the Abrahamic covenant. So it's gone to Abraham, it's been given to Isaac, and now it's given to Jacob by God himself. Now Jacob, though, at this point, is not very mature. His own relationship with the Lord was not yet deep. Now, he calls the place Bethel, house of God, and here's his vow. Look there at verse 20. "If God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take, and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. And this stone, which I have set up as a pillar, will be God's house. And of all that thou dost give me, I will surely give a tenth to thee." At this point, Jacob is self-centered. Remember, he has been doted on by his mother, been under her scheming this whole time to get things. He is selfish. God has just given him these great promises, but his comeback is that well, God will fulfill all these things and bless me in these ways, then here's my deal for God. He will be my God, number one. Number two, I'll give him a tenth of everything that God gives me. Is that a deal? I give you all this, you give me a tenth back, and I'm supposed to be enamored by this. And the kicker is you get this rock for a house. Treating God that way? See, that's where his faith was at this point. He doesn't have a real relationship with God at this point. He is weak in faith. But we're going to find here in the next couple of chapters, as the years flow by, God is going to do many things in his life to bring Jacob into a man of great faith. Now, when Jacob arrives in Haran, he meets Laban and his two daughters, Leah and Rachel. Remember, Laban is his uncle. These would be his cousins. And after some time, Jacob agrees that he will work for Laban for 7 years for the hand of Rachel. That's the dowry price. And 29:20 says, those years seem to him but as a few days because of his love for her. This is a man greatly in love, and it just seems so fast because he knows what he's getting. He's going to get this woman that he loves, and apparently she loved him. This would be great. Now, the wedding came, and now we find Jacob is one to see. Their weddings are not like ours. Our vows are all open to the public. Everybody sees everything. They go through all sorts of ceremonies, but it's dark. It's in a tent. There is no light. And the text says, behold, in the morning it was Leah. This is the wrong girl. Laban, what happened here? I've worked 7 years and don't you know your own daughters? Yeah, he knows his own daughters. His only excuse is that the older in that society was not to be, or the younger is not to precede the older one. The older one had to be given away first. Now talk about a disappointed man. But Laban uses this. So they make a deal, is he will get Rachel as well, but he has to serve for another 7 years. Now, if I was him and he didn't really care for Leah, it's like, I'll cut you a deal. I already worked 7 years for her. You gave me this one instead. Let's cut the number of years. One, two, three, something like that. No, but he really loved Rachel. So 7 more years, he labors. But he does get Rachel as a wife before the 7 years are up. Now, this creates a problem. You have two sisters, and now you have rivalry. Now, Jacob loved Rachel, not Leah, but God allowed Leah to have 4 sons in quick succession. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Now, again, in that society, children were important, especially sons. And with each son, she thought, now he's going to start loving me, as contrasted to her sister, who has no children yet. Well, this gets to Rachel. She is jealous. She demands of Jacob, give me children or else I die. Now, that makes Jacob angry. And his response is a proper rebuke. But understand, in this rebuke is something he's learned about God. Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? He's learned something about God's sovereignty. I can't do things on my own. This is up to God. Well, Rachel decides she's going to do the same thing that Sarah had done. She gives her handmaid Bilhah to Jacob in order to have children by her. And the result are 2 more sons, Dan and Naphtali. Meanwhile, Leah hasn't had a son for a while, so decides she'll do the same thing. She has a handmaid. Zilpah gives her to Jacob, 2 more sons, Gad and Asher. Now after this, Leah has 2 more sons, Issachar and Zebulun, and 1 daughter, Dinah. And Rachel has 0. Genesis 30:22 then says this of her. Then God remembered Rachel, and God gave heed to her and opened her womb. Giving heed to her is Rachel was learning something. She had to have been petitioning the Lord. So she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. She named him Joseph, saying, may the Lord give me another son. So though she was happy about this, she was still a rival with her sister and just wants more kids. But at least her reproach was finally taken away. Well, after the birth of Joseph, Jacob decided it's time to go back home. But Laban, meanwhile, has recognized God has been blessing him because of Jacob. And he wants him to stay and urges him to stay and says, you name whatever wage you want. I understand I'm being blessed because of you. Now, Jacob has increased in his understanding and trust of the Lord at this point, so he sets up his future wages to be totally dependent upon God. It's going to have to be what God provides for him. So instead of some specific salary, he sets his wages to be the animals that are not yet born. The animals that will be in the future will be his wage. And these will be the animals that Laban doesn't even consider as valuable. The flocks would be separated whether they are solid-colored or spotted or speckled. The solid colors were dominant, so Laban was going to get those. And Jacob would take the smaller flock, and we'll see what God does with it. Now, this also prevents deception from either Laban or from Jacob, because it's easy to tell. Is it either solid colored or spotted or speckled? Easy to walk through the flock and tell who has what animal. But it's now completely dependent upon God to either bless or not bless. Now, over the next 6 years, Jacob's flocks increased while Laban's decreased, even when the specifics of who would get which animals changed 10 times. Tells that in Genesis 31:7. As Laban's flocks became smaller, then Jacob became less favorable in his sight, until finally Jacob decided it's time to leave. The angel of God appeared to him in a dream and told him to return to the land of his birth, and that confirmed his decision. He was to head all the way back down, and so he left secretly. He didn't tell Laban. Now, Laban did find out, and he caught up with him 7 days later. He had a three-day lead, eventually caught up with him in the area of Gilead. But God had warned Laban the night before to speak neither good nor evil to Jacob. When he caught up, he told Jacob that he'd acted foolishly. He denied me the opportunity of saying goodbye and sending out with joy. That was a cover. Laban wasn't of that kind of character. But he also said, okay, I can understand you doing this, but somebody also stole my house gods. Jacob explained the fear that he had that Laban would take away Jacob's wives by force, leaving him with nothing. And then also Tom says, then you search through all my belongings, you take whatever is yours, and the one with whom you find your God shall not live. He didn't know Rachel was the one that had taken them. Laban did search through everything. He didn't find the idols that Rachel stole because Rachel hid them in the camel saddle and was sitting on them. Though Jacob was a follower of the Lord, you can see in this, his wives were not wholeheartedly followers of the Lord either. They still had idolatry in their past. They were still grasping onto those things. Well, Jacob now is upset and he contends with Laban. He had undergone a lot of wrongs over the years. He concludes with this, though, and it's interesting because of what it says about his understanding of God. It's 31:42. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction, the toil of my hands, and so he rendered judgment last night. He understands it's God's intervention that is his protection. Though Laban made a false claim that everything was his, the end result was a covenant between them. They ended up piling this huge pile of stones, and that would be a witness of two things. First of all, that God would be a witness between the two of them while they're separated to treat the families properly, but also a witness that if either of them crossed by to return to the other one, it would not be to cause harm. Now, that tells you about the relationship between Laban and Jacob. It wasn't a good one. Here's a pile of stones to remind us that if we ever pass this, you don't come down here to harm me. Well, Jacob offered sacrifices. The next morning, Laban kissed the sons and daughters, and he blessed them, and he returned to his home. Now Jacob has a different problem. In fact, it's a bigger problem. He's going to have to face Esau. It's been 20 years, and Esau, when he left, was plotting to kill him. Esau's had 20 years to figure out what he's going to do when he sees him. Now the angels of God met Jacob as he was on his way, and Jacob then sent messengers to Esau in the land of Seir, that he was returning, and he was seeking Esau's favor. Now, again, Jacob did not know what Esau's reaction would be, so he started preparing himself. He divided his household and all of his flocks into two companies with the idea that if Esau attacked one, at least the other one could escape. Something would survive. Jacob then prayed, as Genesis 32 verse 9. O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who did say to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which thou hast shown to thy servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me, the mothers, with the children. For thou didst say, I will surely prosper you, I will make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Even though he was afraid, Jacob had also become a humble man. He had learned to trust God and God's promises, and that's what his prayer reflects. It's in your hands, God. I'm afraid. He admits it. It has to be in your hands. Well, that night, after he had his family in possession cross the ford of the Jabbok, Jacob was left alone. And we end up with this story of him wrestling the angel of the Lord all night. Hosea 12, verse 4 specifically says it's the angel of God. In the process, the socket of Jacob's thigh is dislocated, but Jacob still is not going to let him go. Not until this angel blesses him. The angel then said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. Israel means strives with God, for you have striven with God and with men and prevailed. And indeed, Jacob was a different man than the one who had crossed 20 years earlier. The next day, Jacob did meet with Esau. Esau had 400 men with him. I'm sure the sight of that wasn't necessarily heartening to begin with. Here he comes, and why does he have all these many men with him? I'm in trouble. Well, he had planned everything very carefully. He kept sending all these gifts in groups to Esau, hoping that would appease him. And then he separated his family so that if one was attacked, the others could escape. Bilhah and Zilpah were first with their sons, and then Leah and her sons, and last was Rachel with Joseph. But all ended up being unnecessary, for when Jacob and Esau met, they embraced and they wept. The old memories, the murderous threats, belonged to the distant past. They reconciled. Esau then offered to travel with him. That's what the 400 men were for. To help along the way. To rejoice in the reconciliation. Jacob declined it because he would have to travel very slowly with all his flocks and young children. Esau returned to Seir, and Jacob made his way to Succoth, and there he built a house, and he lived there for some time. Sometime later, Jacob moved near the city of Shechem, and there he bought a piece of land, and he erected an altar there. He named it El Elohi Israel, meaning God, the God of Israel. God had provided for Jacob all the years he was gone and brought him back safely. Jacob was a true worshiper of God at this point. He finally understood it. But being back in the land did not mean it was safe. In chapter 34, we find that Shechem, he is the son of Hamor the Hivite, he is the prince of the land, he rapes Dinah. Now Dinah is the only sister. And this is a horrible thing to them. To Shechem, he doesn't think twice about it. In fact, now he approaches his father and says, get this girl for me for a wife. Now, when this happens, Jacob's sons are out in the field. Jacob's alone. He says nothing. He waits till his sons come back. When his sons hear about it, they're extremely upset. But they also now know that this man actually wants to marry this girl, and they devise a scheme to get revenge. They agreed to this arrangement. You can have Dinah as a wife if all the men of your city are circumcised as we are. Shechem then convinces all the men to do this on the premise that by intermarriage, all the livestock, all the possessions of Jacob and his family would become theirs. So he appeals to their baser instincts as well. Well, after the men are circumcised and in pain, Simeon and Levi, and remember these are brothers to Dinah, go in and slaughter all the men. And then they loot the city. Now this makes Jacob afraid that the Canaanites, the Perizzites, are going to attack and destroy them. And it was a real possibility. He's not a great group. What would happen if all these people ganged up now that his sons have done this? But the Lord had told Jacob to move to Bethel, and he also put a great terror upon the cities which were around so they would not be pursued. But before they set out for Bethel, Jacob understands some other things. He's got idolatry in his own house. This was a wicked, horrible thing to them, but kind of in keeping with the Canaanites. But he had his own house to clean up. So he had his own house first remove all their idols. Remember, Rachel had stolen her brother's idols? What other idols were in the household? We don't know. He wanted them all gone. He also wanted them to change their garments, purify themselves. And he took all this stuff and he buried it under one of the oaks in Shechem and left it there. He's leaving that stuff behind. If we're going to be a family and want God's blessing, then we have to be doing it right. So he has his household clean up, and then they move to Bethel, where Jacob builds another altar, and again God reveals himself to Jacob, telling him once again his name is now to be Israel instead of Jacob, and again repeats the covenant. Genesis 35:11-12. God also said to him, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply, a nation, the company of nations shall come from you. Kings shall come forth from you, and the land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give the land to your descendants after. Well, that's the very land he was in. The very land that where Shechem was at. That belonged to him by God's design. So the covenant that God made with Abraham, he then established with Isaac, not Ishmael, and then with Jacob, not Esau. There is a specific line. Sometime later, Israel moved down to Bethel, from Bethel down to Hebron, where Isaac was still living. Remember, Isaac thought he was going to die. It's been 20 years since then. Isaac's still alive. However, along the way, Rachel gives birth to Benjamin. The labor is severe, and she ends up dying, and she's buried in Bethlehem. Jacob set up a pillar over it, and that pillar is still there to this day, Rachel's tomb. Chapter 35 concludes with the death of Isaac at 180 years old and being buried by Jacob and Esau. Chapter 36 then records the descendants of Esau. God created a perfect world, but man sinned. God justly punished their sin, but he also gave them this hope of a future redeemer. And what we have seen so far in Genesis is this. That line of redeemer goes through Seth, to Noah, and then through Shem, of Noah's three sons, down to Abraham, who receives this specific covenant. That covenant then is specifically established with Isaac, and then with Jacob. We've also seen something else in this. The lives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They didn't start out as men of great faith. In fact, in all three of them, you can find things initially when we're first getting to know them, they have weak faith. They don't trust God in a lot of things they should trust God for, especially given the promises that they were told. But they rely upon their own wisdom. But as the years go by, we see God put them through different things and bring them to a greater understanding of Him and a trust of Him. So that by the end of their lives, we find that these three men who had been weak in faith have become strong in faith. They've learned to trust God and His promises. You know, God still works the same way with us. It's no different. Too often I find that we as professing Christians, we want to look at someone like David or any of the apostles or Paul or somebody and say, I can never be like that. Yes, you can. They didn't start out where, you know, completely mature, did they? They start out the same place you are. Weak in faith, learning to trust God. And God works in our lives over the years so that we become people of greater faith, a greater understanding of the God that we serve, who He is and what He is like, so that we can walk the way He wants us to walk. That's why it's important to understand is I'm not where I want to be. You're not where you want to be. Someday we will be. Someday we'll be completely glorified. We won't have to struggle with sin. But until that day, we are progressing, being conformed to the image of Christ. And I am not where I want to be. I'm not maybe where other people are at, but I'm not where I was. God is maturing us. And that's one of the things that I found just in doing this study is in the lives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that's encouraging to me. They died mature in faith. They weren't born mature in faith. God's still working in me. He's still working in you the same way. It boils down to this. The sooner we learn to trust the Lord, the faster we mature. Isn't that true? So that's what we're after learning. Learning to trust Him and His promises. To view life in view of what He has said and His character rather than our own failing, frail understanding and will. Let's pray. Father, again, we're very grateful for Your Word, for the lives that are marked off for us in the Scriptures. We recognize that Hebrew tells us that these things were written down for our benefit, that we could learn by them, to learn to avoid the mistakes that they had made, to learn from their failures, but Father, also to repeat their successes, their victories. Father, that we may also be mature individuals. Father, we praise You and thank You for Your great patience with us, Your long-suffering. Father, for even in our failures, You're still there with us, patiently guiding us, directing us. And though we may have to suffer natural consequences from our own decisions and rebellion, yet You chasten those whom You love and continue to conform us to the image of Your Son. That is our desire, to become like Him, that we might glorify You in word and in deed and in attitude. In Jesus' name, amen.